There's a change happening in the way we live, the way we work, the way we spend our money and make our decisions. We are evolving to be more conscious in our actions in a way that serves the world and makes it a better place. Welcome to The Ethical Evolution. The Ethical Evolution podcast is brought to you by the Ethical Change Agency. I'm Bindi, CEO and founder, and I am honoured to bring you the stories of those who create change through paying it forward and giving back. Ethical business owners and holistic healers who are determined to create collective change in the world. Once we have a change in consciousness and through collective change, we can become one. My next guest requested to be on the show, and in reflection, there's no coincidence here that we were destined to meet. The Reverend Dr. Marcia Ledford is a practical theologian and Episcopal priest native to Detroit, Michigan. She worked as a civil rights attorney for over 30 years prior to her ordination. She encourages progressive Christians to exercise their First Amendment guarantees, calling for a more compassionate approach to our social crises in discrimination, exploitation, and equality. Marcia also fought for the civil rights of those in the LGBTIQ community as an openly lesbian woman. I found my time with Marcia fascinating and learned we had so much in common as we both are on a mission for change. Welcome, Marcia, to The Ethical Evolution.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And I am super stoked to have you here. Now, you're coming to us all the way from Michigan, USA.
That's correct.
Can you tell us about you and your background and who you are?
Well, I was born and raised here in the state of Michigan. My dad worked for General Motors. As many of you know, Detroit is home to the big three American automakers. And so I had a good upbringing and the opportunity for education and all of that good stuff. I met my wife of nearly 40 years at college, and we came out at a time when it was not easy. And so I took that experience and I wove it into my law practice. So I was representing the Detroit area LGBT community back in the day when it wasn't cool. And I was telling Bindi before the show, it allowed me to develop what's called in Christian theology the wounded healer. In other words, you take your adversity and you find a way to be a healing presence somewhere else. And so after many years practicing civil rights law, I decided to pursue ordination in the Episcopal Church, which is part of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. And I did a ministry in Southwest Detroit where our Latino populations are largely gathered. And I was just appalled by what I was seeing being done to folks because of our immigration laws. So I decided to go back to school and formally study political theology. And that's what I'm doing now. I founded Political Theology Matters, and I'm writing, speaking, teaching, preaching about the importance of progressive Christians being vocal in the public square for greater social justice. So and there you have it.
Yeah. And, you know, as we were saying off air, like, you know, you're a bit of a unicorn like me. You know, we do a bit of everything. And, yeah. You know, you and I have so much in common, which we've just learnt. Obviously, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a reverend. I haven't worked in law, but, you know, I also have come out gay 20 5 years ago. And, you know, also am one for social change. So, you know, as we start to unravel here, there's so much that we're aligning with here, which I think is absolutely beautiful. And, you know, a lot of people who might be listening to this podcast obviously can't see you, but, you know, you have the whole the Reverend white collar happening, which
the God collar.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You got the God collar happening, which, you know, and also here's one for you. Here's another one. You know, I was christened and baptized Anglican as well here in Australia. So christened, baptized, same thing. Confirmed is the other word I was looking for. So I went through all of that as well. So I completely understand where you're coming from, and the alignment to, you know, how very close that is to Catholic religion as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, liturgically we're very, very similar.
Very, very similar. So, I mean, God, you I shouldn't say that, should I?
Then people then get all nervous and they think they can't swear believe me.
Yeah, no, we're free to do that here. Can I just say that? I have to ask you, though, Marcia, if you could wrap it up in a bow, what is your mission?
My mission is to encourage people to speak out against injustice, and not necessarily just at a protest. That's not everybody's thing. And so we'll get into that a little bit more, but I want to equip and encourage people to speak their faith in the public square for greater social justice. And sometimes in the United States, there's a very important concept called the separation of church and state. It's an ideal. It's not actually written in the Constitution. And people will accuse me of wanting to establish a progressive form of Christianity as a supreme religion in the United States. And I don't, and that's not why the First Amendment was created. It was created to create a forum for us all to speak our minds without retaliation. Because in Europe and whatnot, you know, there was a time when you spoke against the king and got your tongue cut out. So the First Amendment was like nothing the world had really ever seen before. And it gave us a platform for all of us to get involved, not just one or two voices, which we have a little bit of a problem with that right now in the United States.
Yeah. So, I mean, gosh, you must have encountered so much in your years through all of the work that you've done and all that you've experienced. Can you tell us about some of the people that you've helped along the way?
Oh, my. I wasn't expecting that question, so I will think about that for a minute. When AIDS broke out, of course, Lynn and I were young in our coming out experience, too, and we had a lot of gay male friends and started losing them, and that was just incredibly hard. I had a friend, Todd, who was also a young attorney in his mid-20s, and we lost him. And he was so talented and just fabulous, and it was just heart-rending. Mm. So I'm in the U.S., we have something called Social Security, which are benefits for people who reach retirement age or can't work because they have a disability. And I was able to get the first disability rights for a man with AIDS in late stage. It was the first time that it ever happened. And so that was one where I just felt so good about that, because not only did it help him, and he didn't live very long after that, but it gave him some ratification as a human being, because gay men were not being treated like that particularly. And so that was the first thing. And then it created a precedent, which would help other people with AIDS get some additional help, social security benefits. So I'm especially proud of that one. I've helped a lot of lesbian and gay parents either retain custody or retain visiting rights. There was a time when fitness to parent was automatically in question when somebody came out. And particularly it hurt gay men because of AIDS and because there's often this presumption that if a man is gay, he's also a pedophile, which is completely wrong. Pedophiles are pedophiles, regardless of, you know, sexuality. Male to female or female to female or whatever. So there were several of those instances, and I felt really lucky about that. Is that good? I don't want to go on and on.
You know, listening to you describe that, it reminds me of, you know, an era gone by, if I can show my age too. You know, I think in today's age, there is a sector of our community, and I'm talking LGBTQI community, who have no knowledge or understanding of the pain and the suffering that our forefathers went through. Do you know what I mean? Like the whole AIDS epidemic, that in itself, the fear that was underneath that and the suffering that people went through, and just the, even before that, you know, like the laws in different places, how just being gay was illegal, you know, like they have no concept that that actually is a thing in certain places. And you know, it's, I don't know, and I don't want people to take this the wrong way, but I think in some of the younger generations of LGBTIQ community, they kind of think it's almost like a badge of honor. Do you know what I mean? But they don't understand that all the people that have come before them and all the fights they've had to fight to get to where they are and have the freedoms they have today.
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, Linda and I were together 32 years before we were able to legally marry. You know, we'll be married, legally married 7 years in June. You know, I mean,
congratulations. Can I just say congratulations? That's incredible.
Oh, thank you.
That is a very, very long time. And look, you know what? You know, we can do the stats, you know, as long as you like. And same-sex couples are together a lot longer than hetero couples, can I just say? Like, that is an actual stat.
In many instances, I think in some way. Well, do you think, too, part of that is because we just have to fight harder?
Well, yes. It means so much more.
We just have to fight harder to make a home. We don't, you know, when you don't plug into the system, you have to figure out a way either around it or through it or under it or over it, whatever, to protect yourselves legally, to be able to adopt children, you know, has been unheard of. There's lots and lots of things. There are 1,000 benefits that inure to the marriage license.
And, you know, I guess for someone like you who's had a background in law, oh my God, it must frustrate the hell out of you.
Well, it has. It certainly has. I mean, life is better now that we had our Supreme Court decision in 2013. You know, our U.S. Supreme Court said that you have a constitutional right to marry. So, and there are forces at work that want to try and, you know, undo that decision.
Yeah.
And so we're not out of the water. Since Trump has been president, there has been a real blatant attempt to strip away a lot of our hard-won rights in the LGBTQ community. And I do think that since lesbian and gays won the right to marry, We've seen a shift in the scapegoating that goes on over to the trans community. And right now they are really under fire, and we have to do whatever we can to help them, because that happens, you know, and typically here, abortion has been the big lightning rod, and the scapegoating and the shaming and the, all the things that go along with it. and I would say that the Episcopal Church teaches that while there's a tragic dimension to every abortion, we unequivocally agree that women need to have safe, proper reproductive health care. But that whole moral, that whole sense of morality that has been part of the pulse, the underlying pulse of Protestantism in the United States, has fed into this idea that it's okay to vilify a certain group in order to have this high-minded sense of morality. And even, you know, had a movement that Jerry Falwell Sr. started called the Moral Majority, which in my opinion was neither. So.
And gosh, I'm just sitting here listening to you. There's a million questions I could ask you. And, you know, with your background in religion, my gosh, you know, you would have seen as well the bigotry that sometimes comes with that, you know, the yes. beliefs that are enforced upon people that are not their own.
Right. I'm going to talk a little bit about the founding of our country, if it's okay. You know, we had slavery established for probably a century, almost a century before our Declaration of Independence in 1776. So slavery and the denigration of the black and brown body has just always been a part of our national consciousness. And when the country was founded, another thing that was going on was this sense of free white men, limited government, and this moral compass that I just referred to. So there was this very controlling triumvirate that very much is in existence today. And I would say particularly within people who support Trump, this idea of white superiority, white privilege, getting the government out of regulating or preventing discrimination, except, of course, where a woman's choice is involved. And then this idea that somehow the moral compass fell in the hands of this group of folks who are overwhelmingly evangelical Protestants today, and they are allowed to dictate what's right and wrong in the country, what's ethical. And that's a real problem. We have a lot of work to do to educate and eradicate these attitudes, because they're hurting us. It could kill our democracy if we don't get it under control.
And look, Marsha, I don't know how you feel about this, but it really, I don't know, fires me up that a government or a voting public can make a decision about whether you and I could marry, or whether a woman can make a choice about her own pregnancy. How do you feel about that? Like, here we went through a public vote on whether same-sex people could marry. How do you feel about the public or the government making that decision for you?
Well, you know, I ask any heterosexual person to put him or herself in our shoes and think about how on the day we had a life covenant ceremony in 1992, and the papers got a hold of it, and it was under the auspices of our bishop in Southeast Michigan, He knew about it and he said, yeah, you can do it. And the papers got a hold of it and it was a circus. The church where it was going to happen was getting threats. Our guests were being threatened. We ended up reviving an old church tradition of a pew card because in older churches, the pews are numbered. Mm. And so we issued pew cards with numbers on them. And if you didn't have a card, you weren't going to get in the door.
Yeah.
And the Triangle Foundation, which is a LGBTQ plus rights group here, hired bodyguards for us. They were the two biggest men I've ever seen in my life. The one guy stood and just literally framed the door, except that his head went above. Anyway, so imagine having to do that for your wedding.
That's incredible.
Imagine being put in a position where maybe you have to cancel it or you have to reschedule it because it's too dangerous for people to participate. So we eventually put it out in the news that we changed the date, time, and venue, which we didn't. And it worked out fine. We were going to cancel. And Linda's dad said to us, don't let them chase you around. Let people decide for themselves if they want to come. And if you let them do this to you, it'll live with you for the rest of your lives. And I don't want to see that happen.
Mm.
So we did it. And it was a marvelous party, let me tell you. And everything ended up working out okay. But we went through a whole lot. So, yeah, it bothers me. And I will say this. I would rather see our courts interpret the Constitution with respect to equal protection and say, yes, you're being discriminated against unfairly and you have the right to marry, versus having the populace vote. I don't think the population should ever vote on who gets rights and who doesn't, although I respect the fact that you voted on it and it passed. But what happens when people vote on it and it doesn't pass?
Yeah.
And what sort of hegemony does that create? What sort of sense of superiority and inferiority does that create? So now I'm an attorney and I love the Constitution. So, of course, I would rather see the Constitution interpreted in such a way that rights are expanded for everybody as often as possible. But it did make me very angry over the years that we had this loving, caring, stable relationship and we could not protect ourselves legally.
Mm.
So we did the next best thing. You know, we made sure we had wills and we had springing financial powers of attorney, meaning they don't come into effect unless you're disabled. Mm. We have patient advocate designations that handle the medical part. We had all that stuff in lieu of a marriage license that created next of kin status as best we could. So.
Yeah, and I guess that's probably the difference between, you know, the US and here is that the population got to vote on our choice, mm-hmm. which I think annoyed me the most. And, you know.
The voting?
Yeah, yeah. Because
voting on whether you're good enough?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, yeah. You know, to see people within our community actually, you know, even wearing shirts that say yes, to vote yes, mm-hmm. That's one thing. But, you know, just like for you guys in the States with the recent elections, you know, you got your red and your blue. It's exactly the same on an agenda mm-hmm. like this because – you know, there will be sectors of the community who don't believe in this and they will vote no. And it doesn't matter what the result is, they're not going to treat you any different.
No, and they'll feel even more smug about it too.
Yeah.
So, there's that. In when Brown versus the Board of Education was decided in 1954, that was the decision to desegregate the schools.
Mm.
Okay, so that was a huge decision here because of our legacy of slavery, lynching, Reconstruction era lynching, and discrimination, economic exploitation. This was the big one. When we were arguing about whether our children could go to school together, black and white. I think what a lot of people don't know, even here, is that that decision was decided unanimously.
Oh, my God.
The right way. 9-0 to desegregate our schools. I think that that is so much more powerful when our justices interpret the Constitution and determine that equal protection is being violated. Because they are supposed to be neutral and independent magistrates, if you were. They're supposed to look at the law, the face of the law, and not whether their pastor or somebody else is telling people every week that, you know, LGBT people are the devil's minions. We have to have some sense of neutrality and, you know, evaluate what's really going on without all of these other factors coming into play. And that's what happens when you have a referendum on an issue like this. So I don't think civil rights should ever be voted on. They always should be constitutionally interpreted and identified.
Oh, my gosh. I absolutely agree with you on that. Like, you know, I've been at the brunt end of that one. So, yeah, I could not agree more.
It has it infantilizes LGBT people, too. Like, yeah. we can't make these decisions for ourselves, which is ridiculous.
You know, whilst I saw a lot of people around me who, you know, identified as LGBTIQ celebrating the result, which in the end was marginally a yes, I wasn't celebrating because I felt like I still had no say. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So it felt wrong for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I understand.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to harp on about that one anymore.
But there's plenty to harp on about it, believe me.
Gosh, yeah, you could go on, couldn't you? But I'm keen to know, Marsha, like, you know, you wear so many hats and your God collar. What's been the biggest challenge for you and how have you overcome it?
The biggest challenge for me in my life or in this mission?
Both.
Uh-oh. for the mission, it's just finding enough time in the day to get everything done. I'm trying to scale this up slowly. Right now, it's not something where I'm able to make a living doing it. And I say that only because the work is important enough to me that if that turns out to be the case, I'm still going to do it. But it would be nice to be able to have some revenue from it so that I can hire more people to help me. That's really my big challenge. There's, as far as I know, nobody out there doing this, you know, at least in the States. And so it's a lot of fun. It's important. It's exciting. I really love what I'm doing. It's the perfect confluence of all my skills, work experience, passion, sense of call, all of those things. But I just I need more hours in the day.
I hear you.
I
absolutely hear you.
Yeah. So I would say that's been the biggest challenge.
Yeah, and I also share that challenge, you know, and I think all unicorns do, you know, like we're trying to achieve so many things in a day and there's only so many hours, isn't there?
Yep.
So, you know, I'm really looking forward to this answer because, you know, with your background in you know, religion and law and all the things that you do, Can you define for me what being ethical means to you?
Ethical for me is a sense of profound justice, profound fairness. One of the litmus tests that I've always sort of followed in terms of my ethics is if you don't want people to find out about it later, something you're doing, then don't do it because it's not ethical.
Yeah.
Because we're all raised with that sense of right and wrong. And, you know, the news is full of people who steer off that path, even though they know what they're doing is wrong, but they just keep doing it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a pretty simple way. I mean, it's what we teach our kindergartners, and it, you know, it actually works. We start teaching them what's right and wrong from when they're little, when we're all little. And for the most part, I think what we teach as right and wrong is correct. It's just a question of following it.
Mm. Yeah, it's it's that that old if in doubt, don't.
Yeah. If you do it in the dark and you do not want it brought out in the light, then don't do it at all.
Oh, gosh. I love that answer. You know, like, and yeah. I absolutely love that question because there's no wrong answer. And, you know, whatever your perception of ethical is and, you know, what stems from it, there's no wrong answer because it's really just your opinion. And I love it. Absolutely love it. So what are you working on at the moment? I mean, obviously you got so much going on and there's not enough hours in the day. What's happening?
We're in the process right now of developing some courses to help people learn about what public theology is or political theology. You'll hear it called both things. It's the same thing. I define political theology for the average layperson as speaking faithfully in the public square for social justice.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking faithfully, and mind you, this is not just Christianity. This is, you know, whatever your faith tradition is, speaking that faith tradition with authenticity in the public, and that can mean a lot of different things. We'll go into that in a minute, for greater social justice in our policies and laws. And then there's a fourth prong to as large an audience as you can access.
Mm.
So I live in Southeast Michigan. We have the largest Muslim/Arab population in the world outside of the Middle East.
Wow.
We have a very large and active Jewish community here. And so the Abrahamic faiths, Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, are very present and very active here. And so I would be doing them a disservice if I didn't, you know, include them in my mission. And of course, we have a lot of commonality from the Old Testament. So we also have Jains and Hindus and Sikhs and, you know, Buddhists, you name it, we've got it here in Southeast Michigan. So the world's religions all have some form of the golden rule that we call in Christianity, called do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And we can use that as a foundation. We can build coalitions just on that alone. Humanism is basically the embodiment of just taking care of each other, respecting each other. So, for the first part of that, speaking faithfully from your tradition. And then the second part is in the public square. And that could be a lot of places. It could be on a podcast like we're doing right now.
Mm.
It could be on the radio or on television in an interview in that format. It could be speaking at the local park. It could be addressing a committee in the halls of Congress or at the city hall. It could be any number of things, writing an op-ed in the newspaper. So there's lots of different ways for us to get our message out. And then, of course, we want to talk about issues of injustice and talk about why they're unjust and then how to fix them. John Stuart Mill, who lived in the 1800s, said that the in open debate shall you arrive at the truth. And that's what the First Amendment is all about. It's providing an opportunity for many different perspectives to join publicly to discuss the issues of the day in order to find the best course of action. So it's not that I'm saying, you know, we always have to do what the progressive Christians say. So, you know, conservative Christians have a right to speak as well. And we need to work out issues together versus the polarity that we have right now, which in the United States, I think is probably the worst that I can remember as an adult.
Wow. Yeah. And again, you know, like just listening to you talk there, wow, I can relate. You know, as we were discussing off air, you know, I've taken a bit of a different tact in my career to be more of a spiritual coach. And as part of my training, one of the things that we delved into was spiritual philosophy. And, you know, like when you're coaching anyone, you can't be biased in your beliefs. Mm-hmm. And you need to support all schools of thought. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you're doing. You know, most ministers would be, you know, segregated to whatever their beliefs and their religion is.
Mm-hmm.
But you're being very open and inclusive to all beliefs and schools of thought. And that's exactly what we need.
Well, it's definitely what we need here because we are becoming more and more pluralistic.
Mm.
It's been an overwhelmingly Protestant country for many years. I would argue that we even actually had a theocracy, even though the First Amendment prohibits that. and so as we become more diverse religiously, we have to find a way to talk to each other.
Mm.
So that's how I see it. There's a lot of folks who would disagree with me and feel very threatened by that, you know, and so that's part of our big problem, I think.
Yeah.
Christianity in the United States right now is very, very divided.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, like, I mean, as we evolve and time goes on, people's beliefs and thought systems do change and do shift to be more holistic. And, yeah, I think, you know, it's got to evolve like all other systems in life.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, it is more far-reaching than we ever thought. And I got to commend you on the, you know, the perspective that you're taking with it, because I think that's the stuff that actually makes true change.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Marsha, I have to ask you, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go to find out more?
Sure. They can check out my website, which is called politicaltheologymatters.com. And there's information about me and there's information about the mission and you can learn more about what I'm doing. Right now we're developing courses. I think I mentioned that earlier to help people learn about political theology and how they can go about doing it. I'm hoping to, well, I have a book coming out at the end of the year and you'll be able to get more information on that as we get closer to setting an actual date. So, and you can email me at Marcia, M-A-R-C-I-A, Marcia at myptm.com, M-I-P-T-M.com.
Now, I'm not surprised to hear that you've got a book coming. That's no surprise at all. And, you know, and no disrespect to you. You know, you are a reverend, a doctor, probably an attorney as well. You got it all happening. You're a unicorn too. So by all means, whilst I've been calling you Marcia, I'm just been trying to simplify things for myself here.
No, please do. That's fine.
But before we go, I have the big question for you.
Oh, okay.
Are you ready?
I'm as ready as I'm going to be, I think, at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it's still early there for you. It's late here for me.
Yeah.
What's the change you'd like to see in the world and how can we bring it to life?
Holy moly.
Big question, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'll speak to my corner of the vineyard because that's what I know best, and that is we have got to come to grips with racism in the United States. That we have other isms, too, that we seem to be very good at. Mm. Sexism and homophobia and, you know, you name it, we're pretty good at it because we're good at scapegoating groups.
Mm.
And so I would say our big challenge is to really live out, you know, the Declaration of Independence and, you know, the right to pursue life and liberty for everybody instead of it just typically being white people. Mm. That's what we got to do.
Yeah, and I guess from an outsider here in Australia, you know, we look at America and we go, oh, you know, they're all about liberty and freedom and all these kind of things, but there's so much hate and segregation and, mm-hmm. you know, like how does that happen in a country that's so powerful and so large and so developed, you know?
Well, it's like I said earlier, it's been there since the beginning,
mm.
you know, and then we moved westward and we decimated Indigenous persons. And there's just been this sense of white exceptionalism that basically we used it to justify so much of our history. Mm. And we need to stop doing that.
And, you know, like from your experience, I mean, you know, in law, have you seen a degradation, you know, in the way things are?
You mean, do I think it's getting worse?
Yeah.
When Trump took office, I think you can draw a line of demarcation between when we knew that to be blatantly racist or to be openly racist was unacceptable, and he erased that line and made it not only okay, but it became a badge of honor or courage or whatever for people of a certain white supremacy ideology to become very vocal and very, at times, quite violent. And so I have seen that, yes. I think that our society is far worse than it was because Trump gave people who believe they're superior because of their color permission to just act deplorably. Mm. I think people ask me, and this is kind of the way they phrase it, they, you know, have we jumped the constitutional guardrails here?
Yeah.
And I would say that we were on our way over the rails when the election happened. And yeah. then had Trump won, I would have, you know, I would have been very, very concerned. On January 6th, when the Capitol was stormed,
yeah,
I believe that that was an instance where the tires were over the rail, at least, you know, one side of them. Mm. And because it was an attempt to stop a constitutionally mandated action.
Yeah.
Take away all the, you know, all the photos and all the other stuff that went around it, all the emotion and everything. the president invited folks to go and stop the final senatorial count, which is the last step prior to the inauguration of the new president. So there's been a degradation socially in terms of how we talk and act about race and how we treat each other. There's been a greater sense of entitlement to violence. And there has been the development of this idea that we can overturn the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are getting us back on the path in between the guardrails. But I'll tell you that we are still quite vulnerable to this based on what happens in the 2022 elections.
Yeah, there's a lot of damage to overcome, isn't there? Like,
there's a lot of damage, and we could lose both chambers of the House, of the Congress, I mean. That will be a real problem because they're not going to be able to get anything done. Right now, we have a very slim majority because Vice President Harris can break ties in the Senate. So we're going to, you know, we got our stimulus package through without one supporting Republican vote, which is outrageous given how much the American people are hurting in the pandemic and all over the world. But I mean, they have a responsibility to look after their citizens, and they're not doing it. They don't care.
Yeah.
Trump has still got power. I don't know how long that's going to last. So, you know, we are in a very fragile predicament right now. Very fragile. We're on the right path, but we've got to be very careful. And Americans have to be vigilant. We cannot sit on our hands for this next election. We got to get out there and talk about why it's important to protect our democracy.
Yeah. And, you know, like, you know, I don't know how it feels for you guys there in America, but here in Australia, like, it reverberates, you know, we feel it here too, you know. It's in the news. It's like it's happening here. It's like the latest news headlines, you know, particularly when the election was going on. And I remember, you know, we were waiting on the decision and we were watching all the states light up with the different colors. And, you know, we learnt so much during that process. And it was like we were also impacted by that decision, which we are, you know, as far as trade and all those kind of things go.
Of course,
We're as part of it. And it comes back to my thing I always say is that what I do today impacts your tomorrow. We're all in the same place, you know.
We're all in the same boat. And the pandemic has really taught us that.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's taught us about how fragile life is.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
And that we all have a responsibility, not only to ourselves, but to one another, to do the right thing, to be ethical, to get the vaccine.
Yeah. Well, I've got to ask you, Marcia, have you had your jab yet?
Yeah, I've had the first one, and I get the second one on Friday.
Right. Well,
so I've blocked the weekend off in case I
you feel sick,
get zapped. So
yeah, it hasn't quite reached my level yet here. So still waiting, but you know, we're doing pretty well here, so that's good.
Good, very good. Yeah, I don't want to think about what this would be like if Trump had been reelected because. You know, he just did not care about the pandemic, basically, and pretended that it wasn't actually happening. So a lot more Americans died than needed to.
Absolutely.
And so we broke a record the other day. We had 4 million vaccinations in one day.
That's incredible. We're trying to get 1 million by the end of the week, and people are freaking out about that.
You will. You will. Well, Biden said, I want 1 million a day. When he first took office. And of course, now they've got the system in place, the distribution system, and the manufacturers are ramping up their production. So I just think he's done a marvelous job getting the vax out to the peeps because we, you know, there's 300 million of us.
So. Yeah. Well, you have a much larger population than us. So, and we're so far away. Well, Marcia, thank you so much for being a part of the ethical evolution. This has been absolutely incredible. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted to have been here, and thank you so much. I love what you're doing. I think your show is important. I think your show is about, you know, getting back to drawing that through line of right and wrong.
Mm.
And we seem to be gravitating away from that. And so when you have your shows, you're helping us all remember that that's an important thing to do.
Thanks for listening to the Ethical Evolution Podcast. If you're an ethical business owner, change maker, or holistic healer who's determined to make a change in the world and you need support to spread your message, visit ethicalchangeagency.com to collaborate.